Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, Zora Neale Hurston is a name that by now most people who read books are familiar with. But as a black woman in the 1920s and 30s, she struggled financially and professionally to keep going and find her place. And while she gained fame as a novelist by the late 1930s, by a decade later she had fallen into obscurity again, dying poor in 1960. It wasn't until nearly 20 years later that she was resurrected and recognized as the genius that she was. So on Tuesday, January 17th, the PBS series American Experience will premiere the new film Zora Neale Hurston, Claiming a Space. My guest is the film's writer and director, Tracy Heather Strain. Welcome, Tracy.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to speak to you today about this documentary.
Yep, it's great to have you on. So why don't we just plunge in and tell us about Zora Neale Hurston's childhood and early years.
Zora Neale Hurston grew up in Eatonville, Florida, which was one of the few incorporated all-black towns in the United States at that time. She lived with her parents and seven siblings and has shared in later writings that she enjoyed listening to adults tell stories on the porch of the general store in town. It seemed like she was really attracted to hearing adults talk and telling stories and paying attention to what they did.
You know, I'm from Florida myself and lived in Central Florida for many years. And so being in that area, which was at that time really the Deep South, she probably, I'm guessing, lived kind of a sheltered childhood in the sense that she wasn't exposed to, you know, to the intense racism that she might have been exposed to elsewhere, because, as you say, she lived in a town that was an all-black town, Eatonville, Florida. You know, so she probably had kind of a happy childhood compared to what she might have otherwise experienced in other places. But I saw in your film, which I was fortunate enough to see a preview of, that her mother emphasized education and gave her her independent streak, which one of your narrators called her superpower, but also her fatal flaw. But her mom died when she was 13. And then she became uprooted and was shuttled from house to house for several years. So how did that experience, which was a kind of a sudden, abrupt jump shift from her earlier childhood, how did that experience affect her?
First of all, both of her parents emphasized education, but it was her mother who really encouraged her creativity and gave her kids permission to, as she called it, jump at the sun. But when her mother died, her father got remarried immediately. The children were upset, and basically Hurston recalls that she was on her own primarily for the rest of her life. She described those years after her mother died as haunted, and we really don't know how she lived for a long time. So imagine your mother passing away, the person who's telling you that you can basically do anything, be anything, and then she's gone, and she's out alone at 13 in the world. But she did say that being alone and dealing with those years that she describes as the haunted years, where we really don't know what she did to survive, made her ready for her future life doing field work.
Yeah, so it was kind of the school of hard knocks, I guess is the phrase I was searching for, that she suddenly was thrust into. But she still retained her passion for education and was persistent in trying to follow her education, even though she was, you know, not exactly living on the streets, but she was living a very uprooted childhood. And she found, wherever she went, she found a way to go to school. And I guess, you know, again, you know, the story in your film is that she shaved 10 years off her real age. So she must have been youthful compared to her, you know, to her biological age. So tell us about her pursuit of education and where she went as she got on in life.
Zora managed to land in Baltimore. She realized that if she wanted to get a high school education, because she didn't have the money, she would have to lie about her age. And that's what she did. She went to night school first, and she worked during the day. And then somehow she managed to get to the private school, Morgan Academy, and she worked there as well. But her talent was recognized by classmates and teachers, and they encouraged her to apply to Howard. And then before getting accepted into Howard, she had to go to Howard Academy, and she gets her high school diploma. Again, she's always working through all of this, and then begins Howard part-time because she has to work. This woman was so interested in getting an education that she found a way, and she was someone who was at Howard and founded the Howard newspaper, the daily that's still in publication. It wasn't a daily at the time, but she was a part of a literary select. She was very much interested in learning, and she was encouraged to write at Howard. But then she was encouraged to move to New York and left Howard. She'd only received an associate's degree, which she had done very early on, and got accepted into Barnard basically by going to a party and impressing wealthy founder of Barnard College, and that's how she ends up at Barnard. And then it was not easy for her. She attended teas and parties. She let the students there at Barnard think she was special, but she never let anyone look down on her. But it wasn't always easy. Sometimes she'd walk around with this famous writer that she was friends with and worked for, named Fanny Hurst. And it helped Hurston have her white peers take her more seriously. But she ended up graduating and getting through, and it led to the opportunity of that, you know, sets a new course for her life.
Yeah, so Barnard College is an elite women's school at the time, and were there any other black students at Barnard at the time?
According to Barnard, it doesn't appear to be that there were any other black students at the time that Zora Neale Hurston was there. She described herself as Barnard's sacred black cow.
Well, there was also a place where nearly all of the students were from wealthy and privileged backgrounds, and of course she was not. So she was sort of, you know, out of place in that sense too. So she really, really stood out as probably a unique individual on campus. And I guess, you know, what comes through a lot with her is her persistence, but also her charm and her ability to kind of make her way in tough circumstances just by her personality alone and not by contacts or money and so on, right?
Zora Neale Hurston was quite resourceful, and the progressive students that she befriended, some of them helped her. She went to people's homes and they taught her different things related to social etiquette. But she was charming and she was gregarious. But you're right, she did not have financial resources that most of her classmates had. And she was working, as she always had to do. Her entire life, she just never gave up.
So I guess she graduated from Barnard and she began, I guess, her, you know, as she moved through college, she had the ambition to become a teacher, which was, you know, one of the few professions that women in general had open to them back in those days, right? And so how did she make the transition to becoming a cultural anthropologist, which is a whole nother kettle of fish from being a teacher?
Zora Neale Hurston wrote a paper in an anthropology class. She had been encouraged to take the anthropology class because her schedule was so, I guess, literature heavy. In that class, she wrote a paper that was brought to the attention of Franz Boas, who is considered one of the world's most renowned anthropologists. He was literally changing the discipline. He met with Zora. He summoned her, as they say, to his office, and he saw something in her that suggested she could do anthropology, and he encouraged her to do anthropology. And she took three classes and did field work in Harlem measuring people's heads. The reason she wanted to work with him, we suspect, is that he gave her an opportunity to see her own culture in a new way, to study it. She describes in Mules and Men that it was anthropology that provided like the spyglass to be able to look at her own self and her culture and see that folklore and other cultural practices of African Americans were important and worth studying.
Yeah, so Professor Boas there at Columbia University, I think, was doing American anthropology largely and was studying different indigenous groups, you know, Native Americans and so on. And so I suspect that his interest in her was that she was highly intelligent and already well-educated and personable, and she was black. And so she could be like an emissary or an agent or, you know, kind of a conduit into the black community. But so she went on a folklore collecting expedition that she was funded on back to Eatonville, her childhood home. But, you know, I gather she ran into a wall of resistance there and at the same time disappointed Professor Boas back at Columbia. So there was kind of a mismatch there of her approach and their academic expectations. So why don't you describe that some?
So stepping back just a second, that Franz Boas was considered the father of modern anthropology and of American anthropology, as opposed to like the British style of anthropology. And he was perceived as an anti-racist figure. So he set up a trip for her to go collecting. She technically hadn't graduated yet, but she had basically done most of her coursework. And when she went down to Eatonville, she was using the techniques that she'd learned in college, and she was speaking very proper. As she described it, she was speaking Barnardese. "Pardon me, do you know of any folk tales around here?" And she recalls that the people that she knew had folk tales, this is a paraphrase, oozing out of their bodies. It's like, no, we don't know anything like that. Go over there, check with them. And so it was her formality that was the problem. And no one wants to feel like they're an object of this, of study. She called this resistance that Black people often gave featherbed resistance. And so the next time she traveled to the South, she realized she needed to gain trust. She made people feel more comfortable with her because she spent time with them and she shared stories and experiences. And in fact, she fabricated some stories to try to explain why she had the car she had on the second trip down.
Yeah, I think with any group, gaining trust is important before they'll open up to you. I mean, and if they think you're just there to exploit them, which of course, you know, Black people in the South had some experience with before, let's say, and if they think that you're just there to use them for your own purposes, they're not going to open up to you, even if she was in Eatonville where she grew up and knew people, right? But she probably had changed enough that they viewed her as an outsider, I'm guessing. So then someone appeared in her life named Charlotte Osgood Mason, who became her benefactor and employer. So tell us about that and how that interacted again with the academic side of her motivations for doing what she was doing.
Charlotte Osgood Mason was a white, wealthy woman in New York who supported a number of artists and writers considered to be part of the Harlem Renaissance, including Langston Hughes and Elaine Locke. And Charlotte Osgood Mason employed Zora Neale Hurston to collect folklore. Literally, there's a contract that says she was an employee. Mason was also someone who was anti-academic. So here you have Hurston, who did not have legal claim to the materials that she would subsequently collect. But she's still connected with Franz Boas, and this puts her in a difficult position in terms of working with him, because legally she's not supposed to share the material because it's Charlotte Osgood Mason's material. But she wants to be a good scientist, and she wants Franz Boas's guidance. So she's in at a hard place. She's juggling these relationships as well as trying to figure out also what she wants to do for herself.
Yeah, so she's kind of running two parallel paths at the same time and playing one against the other to some extent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was an honest and honorable person, but that must have been very conflicting for her. Gosh. But I guess she found a way to do that, at least for a while, to satisfy both her academic mentor and her financial benefactor, which would have been tricky for her.
Yeah, she did publish two pieces, one major one in the Journal of American Folklore. And so that, you know, is considered a prestigious academic journal. And a whole publication devoted to her study of hoodoo in America. That's quite impressive.
Hoodoo in America. Yeah, be interesting to read. But did that publication, being academic, did that alienate her to some extent from her anti-academic benefactor, Osgood Mason?
You know, to be honest with you, that one, I don't know what the story is. But Osgood Mason was okay with Zora Neale Hurston publishing about her work in the Bahamas because it wasn't American. So she let Hurston publish that. I'm not sure. I don't have any particular research that explains why it was okay to publish Hoodoo in America, but it got published.
One interesting thing is that Osgood Mason, this wealthy white woman, gave Hurston a movie camera, which was an expensive and rare tool for an anthropologist at that time. And so how did that augment her work? I mean, I know your film is filled with documentary footage that she shot, that Hurston shot with that camera. And the film wouldn't be what it is without the footage that Hurston herself shot, you know, way back then.
Well, the beauty of the situation of Zora Neale Hurston having a movie camera in 1927 to take down with her, is that we have these wonderful images of everyday rural Black adults and children from 1927, 28, and 29. A lot of material that was shot around that time, before that time, has not been preserved. So this is the beauty of the situation today. And our film, we make use with as much of that footage as we could. It's the storytelling is supplemented by other archival imagery, but we actually identify when we're using Zora Neale Hurston's footage on the screen.
Sure.
So people know. But back when Hurston was using the motion picture camera as part of her ethnographic research, anthropology was not interested in using motion pictures in ethnographic research. It was expensive, it's cumbersome. And they felt like the details of what the discipline required at that time could not be captured or collected through motion pictures. So you know, if you want to know exactly, think of classic anthropology. You're in the field, and the quote unquote natives are there, and you want to write down all these things. That's what they were. It's very text based, right? And so the camera, I mean, think about, I don't know how many people, you know, are familiar with how to shoot film, that you have to, when you have film, you have to keep it out of the sun. You have to load it in the dark. You have to make sure the exposures are correct. And then you have to unload it in the dark, and then it has to be processed somewhere. And so I have no idea how she learned how to operate a motion picture camera and where this material was processed and when.
Yeah, I wondered about that too, because it's high quality footage, and you know, it's movie quality footage for that time practically. And it's funny to watch the subjects, the people she's filming, who have never been filmed before, you know, and probably in many cases never even had a photograph taken of them before. And so they're kind of, you know, mugging for the camera some. And I remember reading a novelist, John Barth, one time said, "The necessity for an observer makes perfect observation impossible." And she alluded to that, that the fact that she was there documenting things made her subjects act a little different, you know, because it was impossible for them to be unaffected by her presence, right? So that was a factor.
Yes, it's something we deal with in documentary all the time, that, you know, a camera can change the experience. But what I see in the footage is I see people who seem very comfortable with Zora Neale Hurston, and very, I feel the warmth. I don't know if people had been filmed before Zora Neale Hurston. I suspect people have been to the movies and seen footage, but I do think that it is extraordinary that Zora Neale Hurston was able to bring just ordinary people's lives to the screen. It's
Yeah, I
not, you
was
know,
thinking
she's
at the
not
end.
fancy. She's not filming fancy people. She's not filming the middle
Oh,
class.
yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah, it's not scripted and they're not all dressed up or whatever. They're doing what they do on a day-to-day basis. But one thing I thought was kind of unfortunate is she was the one doing the filming. So she was filming all these people, but there's no footage of her really to speak of, at least in those contexts there out in the field, because she's the one behind the camera.
The
So, yeah.
exception of that is when she's in 1940, when she's in Beaufort, South Carolina, and she requested a film crew to come, and you can see Zora Neale Hurston in walking into the church and then playing the drums, and then later, if you take you there's a sneak peek of her when they're doing a baptism, they're standing by the water, you can see her with a little boy in the back. So we make use of those images as well and start the film with that.
Yeah, so one thing that was interesting is she interviewed someone named Cujo Lewis, who I gather was the last survivor, last living person from the slave ship named Clotilde, which was itself the last of its kind because it was illegally run after the abolition of slavery. And Cujo Lewis was the last living person who was on that ship, and therefore was the last living person in America who remembered being captured in Africa and brought into slavery. And so she interviewed him and spent quite a bit of time with him and wrote a book called Barracoon. And Barracoon, I guess, refers to the, it's where our word barracks derives from, the places that slaves were held during the transshipment process on the coast of Africa before they were picked up by the slave ships and taken across the ocean. And she wrote that book and began to seek a publisher for it in 1931, but it wasn't published until 2018, 87 years later. And I bought it and read it, and it's fascinating. But can you tell us why it wasn't published for 87 years?
Sure. For the record, it turns out that Cujo Lewis was not the last enslaved person. And even Zora Neale Hurston, I think, had located one other person. But Hurston's manuscript, Barracoon, was not published during her lifetime because the publishers wanted her to change how she wrote Cujo Lewis's dialogue, which we might describe as African American vernacular English today, with a greater emphasis on the African language than maybe people speak now. But Hurston refused to revise the dialogue. She wanted an authentic representation of how Cujo Lewis spoke, and that's what she wanted published. It didn't happen when she tried to do that in 1931, but it happened in 2018. I mean, Hurston was interested in the diaspora and how African traditions had influenced African American traditions. And his method of speech was important, not just because it was authentic, but because it offered a glimpse into how African language was infused into English by enslaved individuals.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Tracy Heather Strain, who is the writer and director of a new documentary film about Zora Neale Hurston, the anthropologist and author. And it's called, oddly enough, Zora Neale Hurston, Claiming a Space, and will be shown on January 17th on PBS series American Experience. So around this time, again, that book Barracoon was first finished in 1931, but Hurston began to be more an author and emphasized that side of things, which he had wanted to do. And she became a playwright and kind of ran into resistance from both her benefactor and the Harlem Renaissance intellectuals. The play was called The Great Day. So just tell us kind of briefly about that and the effects on her financial support.
Well, Hurston had been writing plays at least since Howard. And during the period of time between her mother's death and enrolling in night school in 1917, she traveled with a Gilbert and Sullivan troupe, serving as a lady's maid to an actress. And so she had a background in drama and theatrical presentations. Mason's reluctance to support Hurston's play, The Great Day, is very complicated because Mason feared that the material would be stolen, that Mason would lose control of it. And the production was very different from other productions that were out there at the time. The songs were unarranged because Hurston wanted those to be authentic. Hall Johnson, the famous black theatrical composer, told her that white audiences would not be ready for it. Even he was impressed in the end and congratulated her for what she did. But Hurston so believed in this play that she used as much of her own money as she could, and she borrowed money from Mason to put it on. But it did not find backers. Hall Johnson was correct. Mm. And imagine that we're also in the midst of the Great Depression, or the Great Depression is starting. And it appears that Hurston was very stressed from this, depressed and worn out, and had to ask Mason for money, not only to get down to Florida, she was sick, but she had to ask Mason for money to get a new pair of shoes, because apparently Mason only let her have one pair of shoes at a time.
Oh my gosh. Poor thing. So, I mean, so again, as you mentioned, Tracy, we're in the Great Depression by this time, and here she's got a play that that bellied up and was also putting strain on her financial benefactor. And so she then wrote a novel called Jonah's Gourdvine, and that luckily was a success. And so I think she sounded like she'd finally found a way to do her thing her way and get paid for it and not have to rely on someone else and always be on bended knee to someone else with your hand out. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Do you think that was maybe her personal high point, was the success of her first novel that way?
I don't know for sure. I'm sure she was quite excited. For me, I have to imagine getting back-to-back Guggenheims to be maybe a personal high point for Zora Neale Hurston. I mean, she's getting support, and you know, this is happening later. She's getting support to travel to do research on her own after the fiasco of having had her fellowship plans for a PhD in anthropology to fall through. And, you know, look, Margaret Mead never received a Guggenheim. But, you know, Jonah's Gourdvine was Hurston's first mainstream success as a writer, and it helped prove that there was an audience for her work and established helped establish her as a literary force.
Yeah, there was, again, we're getting to the end of the show, so we're going to have to kind of compress things here, I guess. But again, during the Depression, which was as it was, work and money were hard to find. She went to work for the Federal Works Project Administration's Florida Writers Project as a folklorist. I did a show here on American Variety a few years back on a man named Stetson Kennedy, who was kind of a legendary person in the history of Florida. He was the project manager for that Florida Writers Project, and Zora Neale Hurston was one of the staff working with him on it. And I remember in the show that it was the white project staff would all stay in a hotel, but she had to go find either sleep in her car or find a house of somebody in the area who would take her in and let her spend the night on their couch. I mean, so it was an awkward and difficult thing. But, you know, as always, she was very positive and just kind of rolled with the punches and went with the flow and did what she had to do to get her work done. And Stetson Kennedy viewed her as a very strong ally and asset to the project they were doing. But she went on then, I'm kind of skipping ahead here, so just to say through her chronology, she wrote Mules and Men, which was another well-received book, and then finally wrote Their Eyes Were Watching God, which was a critical success, but oddly enough didn't sell well, and it ended up in later years being the thing that she's most known for, but it drew criticism from the black intellectual elite. So just briefly, if you can, tell
sure.
us about that.
Right. Just one quick thing. Mules and Men established her in the mainstream as an anthropologist and a writer, but Mules and Men was really more about her research. Their Eyes Were Watching God, as we describe in the film, is more literature with anthropology infused within. And there were male African-American critics, fellow writers, who did not respond positively to Their Eyes Were Watching God. They were critical of Hurston's use of Southern Black dialect. They saw it as an outdated trope that mirrored the minstrel technique. But it was a groundbreaking book for its depiction of Black love and the centering of Black female perspective, which is one of the reasons the book means so much to readers today. But at the time, the book was seen as being apolitical and frivolous. They didn't understand the nuances of the text, which discusses power, racism, sexism, colorism, and the legacy of slavery. It is more subtle than what was becoming popular at that time when the book was released.
Yeah, so she finally did write an autobiography called Dust Tracks on a Road, and by then she was recognized as a prominent literary figure, but the decline of her fame and reputation came really suddenly. So just very briefly, if you can, what happened?
Zora Neale Hurston had difficulty finding writing work. She wasn't getting the money to continue the ethnographic research she wanted to do. She had to juggle various jobs to stay alive. There are false accusations made against her for having improper relations with a minor. She focused her work on Black culture, and that topic suddenly was not in vogue anymore. And while she continued to write all her life, she never had the financial support to pursue the work she wanted to do. One point she was working as a maid and someone recognized her, and she kind of played it off as if she was doing research, but she needed that money to stay alive.
Yeah, so she ended up in Fort Pierce, Florida, which is where one of our major stations is located, and actually where I went to high school, and working as a maid, just as a maid in Fort Pierce, Florida. And she died basically in poverty in 1960, and wasn't until a number of years later, more than a decade later, that the novelist Alice Walker rediscovered her and kind of brought her reputation and her brilliance and her life's work back into visibility and then prominence. So now we know, you know, who she was, and your film will continue the building of her legacy. But Tracy, just what do you think? How is she seen now? Is she seen as more of a novelist or as an anthropologist? And how do anthropologists view her work?
I sort of Hurston is viewed by people who are familiar with her biography and work as ahead of her time, in many cases a genius. There's a lot of interest in her writings and life with the publication of Barracoon and the collection of her essays, You Don't Know Us Negroes. And this documentary, I think, also speaks to people's interest in her. It's hard for me to know how anthropologists view her work. I think it depends on the anthropologists. I know African-American and Black anthropologists definitely recognize her as someone to admire. But I think that for most people, they still perceive Hurston as a novelist. And I'm hoping that this film will broaden people's notions of who she was, what she was about, and how brilliant she was. She knew so much. She was so well-read. She studied and worked very hard. She was not a slacker at all.
Yeah. Well, we are going to have to leave it there. And again, Tracy's film, Zora Neale Hurston, Claiming a Space, will air this Tuesday, January 17th, on the PBS series American Experience. Tracy, I want to thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.